Welcome to the Brothers in Aerospace and Defense, the podcast that delves deep into the world of aerospace and defense with a unique perspective. I'm Dwayne Allen, your P&L host.
And I'm Rob Wesley, your technical host. And on today's episode, we're pulling back the curtain on one of the most critical, but also underappreciated aspects of the aerospace and defense industry, and that's the contract models.
Yeah, today we're pulling back the curtain on how government contract types really drive risks, margins, engineering choices from firm fixed price to fixed price incentive fee to cost plus to IDIQs to even PBLs. And if you win work or won programs or price proposals, this episode is for you.
So if you're a system architect or a CFO trying to forecast revenue for the next year, this episode is really going to give you that ammunition to really delve deep into the critical aspects of, program performance, program executions.
So let's get into the newsreel. Here's the newsreel for October 2025. Boeing CH-47F Chinook Lot 4 and 5 award. The U.S. Army awarded Boeing a $461 million contract for 9 CH-47Ls Block 2 Chinooks under a firm fixed price model, underscoring the DoD's continued push for predictable cost structures on mature platforms. Number two, hybrid air vehicles. Hybrid air vehicles landed its first military reservation for 3 Airlander 10 hybrid airships. The contract represents experimentation with persistence, endurance, and low-cost ISR and communication roles. These areas are ideal for hybrid contracting approaches. And last, but certainly not least, we're in the midst of a government shutdown. Right, the shutdown has been over 30, going over 36 days since October 1. Approximately 900,000 federal employees are furloughed, with another 700,000 working without pay. The economy is losing about $15 billion in GDP per week. And this key affects our business, right? It's the defense contracts awards are delayed. The payment cycles are slowed down. Procurement offices are operating at reduced capacity. And this impacts all kinds of proposal reviews and source selections as well. Rob, what's screaming at you for the newsreel this week?
I mean, I think I'll be remiss because I'm in the D.C. area. I think the government shutdown has had a great impact on this area in itself, just from all the, major defense contractors, government employees, everyone that's in this area. It's been super affected, over the past over a month at this point. So I'm hoping, we could all come together and get this, up and running again, because I think that's going to be critical for our industry as we move forward.
Absolutely. We just need our elected officials just to come back to the table and get this done, get this fixed. It's never a good thing when there's a shutdown for either side you're on. So let's just go get it done, make it work. So let's get on to segment one. In this segment, we're going to talk about why contract models matter, right? And I'm going to talk about, from a business perspective, the drivers of that. And then from Rob's perspective, he's going to talk about the technical drivers, right? So at its core, right, a contract is a legal thermostat of a program, right? It is determines who carries what risks, what are the upsides, how changes are handled, how performance is judged. But in aerospace and defense, these decisions are not just financial. They ripple into the entire value stream, from engineering, procurement, testing, sustainment, and even administration, right? What kind of reports we need to give out. And there's four things you need to think about, from the what that you as you're putting this thing together. You got to think about risk allocation, right? If the contractor agrees to a firm fixed price model, then they absorb the technical schedule risk. If it's cost plus, then the government absorbs much more on that risk side. You got incentives and alignment that's there, where the models can include, performance-based payments on bonuses and also lose penalties, any type of profit incentives, and then cost sharing from that perspective. And then you got change management and flexibility, and particularly when you have these long, complex programs like a missile program or hypersonics or satellite, right? You think about change is always inevitable, but the contract must support or restrict the ability to adapt to what's happening. And then, like I talked about earlier, the administrative stuff, right? Certain contract types will deal with, accounting and cash flow and how you forecast and how do you think about how you actually acknowledge a unit of sale of that contract, and then for us accounting people, that matters a lot. So that's what on the business side. Rob, what do you got on the technical side? Just really get into some examples for us.
Yeah, and I'll anchor this with two, you know, quick examples. So from a firm fixed price standpoint, let's say the scenario is that when you bid what you think it will cost and deliver to that price, but, you know, suppose an unexpected design challenge emerges midstream that, you know, you have to account for that cost. You know, who eats that cost? And that's going to be the actual contractor is going to eat that cost. Right. So that's great for the customer because they are just focused on predictable costs. But it's really dangerous for the contractor because in this high tech, high software, high uncertainty domains that are going on right now with AI and, you know, machine learning and all that, it's a lot of unpredictability in that, you know, cost that we want to, you know, move forward with. Second example is really going to get around cost reimbursement. So that's like the CPIF, CPFF. You know, in this example, the government reimburses allowable costs plus a fee or an incentive. So you reduce the risk of surprise problems down the road because you have that cost fixed in into the actual proposal. So it's less margin of error, but you also have to undergo a lot of rigorous audits and justifications for those costs because the government wants to really truly understand, are these costs associated with the program or is this cost associated with your own, you know, contracted development for these systems? So I'll break those down into those two examples. Dwayne, anything else you want to hit on this topic before we move forward?
Yeah, you got hybrids, right, that occur at combinational contracts like a T&M, a time and material contract, or IDIQ, indefinite delivery, indefinite quantity type contracts. You got these recurring tasks that you might want to do that shows up for like maintenance and operation sustainment, that shows up in like performance-based or logistics contracts, usually on the back end of the value stream, and or those outcome-based contracts where, hey, you do X, you have to perform X, has to come to this, and then you get the profile. We'll unpack these model, how these contract models really will best to a mission profile later on in the podcast. Before we jump back in, please hit subscribe on your podcast platform, right? It helps us continue to bring this content to you. We really appreciate it. And if you prefer watching this on YouTube, please hit the subscribe button there. You can watch the full video version. As always, hit like and things like that and comment and share for what you see with your friends. We really appreciate delivering this content to you. This is a way for us to know that we're giving you the right things that you want to hear. Let's get into segment two then.
Okay, so now we're going to jump over into segment two of our episode today. So that's really talking about the contract types and also their engineering impacts. So from a firm fixed price standpoint and fixed price incentive fee, the definition structure around it is that you commit to deliver scope X for price P, and then in the firm fixed price incentive fee, you add a sharing formula to calculate that incentive fee. And if you come under that cost, you share the savings with the customer. But if you're over that cost, then you have to share the pain of the, you know, above that ceiling cost with the customer. The engineering implications are really around how do you aggressively manage the cost, test margins, scope creep, leaves little room for surprise tech risk because it's firm fixed price. But it motivates you to have that robust risk analysis, trade studies, and margin the buffers in this contract scope. Business trade-offs, you want to handle that, Dwayne?
Yeah, it's all about like, it's really high risk for the contractor. And this is what we're seeing now in industry that's coming out. But actually what our customer is demanding is very high TRL type capabilities when we're even with brand new capabilities out. So everybody's favorite term, AI, machine learning, things that really haven't been solved out completely for that. The customer's asking for this capability, but they want it on a firm fixed price contract. Or they want you to already develop the capability and have it ready to roll from get going. This traditionally, you know, that's seen, you know, as a seller's market for them, because that's when the domain's understood. But right now, traditionally in the marketplace for big programs, we don't see that.
They want the plug and play model right now. That's so right. It's just, that's they right. want the lot of software, plug it into their system, whatever, you know, autonomous system they want to plug it into and have it to work. And that's it.
Can't even spell AI, but want it, right? You know, that's the fun part we always talk about.
So the second contract type we're going to talk about today is cost reimbursement. So I touched a little bit about this earlier with my example, but the definition structure is really you get reimbursed for allowable cost under this umbrella fixed contract plus the fee. So that fee can be incentive, award, or it can be fixed. The engineering impacts of this type of contract is it's much more flexible to change and response to the uncertainty that we talked about with all the new software type capabilities and products going on. It really requires a strong cost control because you have to really justify what's allowable versus unallowable in the contract structure. And also you have to be ready for audits and be compliance with cost principles. Dwayne, what about the business side?
On the business side, it's, you know, lower risk. You know, we love to see this one coming, right? It's just saying, hey, you know, for the changes that you're going to have, you know, we'd love to see a cost reimbursable type of contract structure, right? With some type of, you know, fee or incentive award that gives you that you negotiate as you move forward. But it has lower profit potential. And obviously with that is a lot more overhead, a lot more oversight. But again, and we're starting to, and like I said before, just as the customer's trying to see more and more the letting and having the requirements of firm fixed price, we're seeing less and less of these cost reimbursable type deals, unless they're on smaller type efforts. You know, you'll see those, but for the big programs, it's going to be firm fixed price all day.
Yep. Absolutely. Third contract type is indefinite delivery, indefinite quantity. So really, this is really when the government defines a ceiling number of units or ceiling dollar value, and the government issues that individual task delivery orders under that umbrella. So think of this as like the overarching contract model, but then you have other task orders and things like that, you know, flow into this from a use case standpoint. So use cases are really about like when you have a lot of parts, spares, engines, sustainment, where you don't know exactly the demand up front, but you want to have coverage for the entirety of the, you know, let's say the product life cycle or the contract life cycle. Engineering impact is, you know, it really needs architectural modularity, supply chain readiness, plug and play design to respond to all the various orders that's going to be going on, because like I said, it's going to be coming from spares, production, sustainment. So it has to, you know, take in consideration for a lot of different quantities. Dwayne, what about the business?
You said it perfectly. The other thing about an IDIQ, it can also have different elements of the value stream in an IDIQ, right? It can have I want you to produce a widget 1 through 20, and I might order 10. Also, it'll mm-hmm. have a development, you know, clean contract line item that's in it based and say, hey, can you upgrade the seeker on widget X? And I want you to start delivering that from 11 through 15, right? And you'll have, and then, hey, and then on another clean, it can say, hey, I need you to do some support and sustainment work. So those IDIQs give the contracting entity the realm and the stretchability to figure out how to do a lot of things under one contract umbrella, which is can be helpful and smart when you're dealing with particularly in a sustainment environment or you're upgrading something that's already in the fleet. So you'll see a lot of these, right?
Yeah. And this is where those task orders, when you talk about clean updates, you know, that's where those task orders get flowed out. So like, hey, this task order is up for 11 through 20, or this task order is for like 5 through 6. So it, you know, has that flexibility to roll out those different aspects of that.
Right. We got one more, Rob. What you think? What we got?
Yeah. So the last two we'll lump it in together. So time materials. So that's labor hours. So it's really, you know, really simple. You know, time materials is like pay for the laborers plus the materials. And in use cases, really, it's when you can't precisely define the scope up front, and you have a lot of R&D prototyping exploratory work. This is really the type of contract you want to have. So it's for engineering trade-offs, it's really easier for those changes that are going to be going on for this. But you still must control that inefficiencies for those labor hours, because you want to make sure that you're staffing to the right levels, not producing unproductive work in these contracts. The last contract type is, I'll jump into this one. So it's performance-based, outcome-based, availability contracts. So that's when, instead of paying for something specific deliverables up front, you pay for the outcomes. So X percentage of availability, some type of uptime when the mission is completed, is often used in sustainment, logistics, MRO, sustainment availability contracts. You really need that diagnostic tools, health monitoring, prognostics, and that maintenance for the engineering implications of this. So you don't want to expose yourself too much to faults, or but to have that reliability and you know, spare parts and supply chain resilience throughout that. Dwayne, you know, walk us through the last business impacts of, you know, both of those type of contracts.
Yeah, from you know, time materials is really, you know, like you said, it's, hey, I got some engineering work I need you to figure out, or I need you to figure out, explain to me what does, you know, this new technology mean, and here's some hours to go do that. And so we'll present a white paper, right? And say, we call it, where we just give them an engineering document to say, here's what it takes to do X, Y, and Z to build this capability to your new platform, things like that. So, because they need the just the basic information to say, how would you do it, right? And you'll see that in a from a time and material standpoint, right? Or in a support structure where, hey, we might need some help with some flight integration. Here, we'll give you a time and materials contract just so we can have some people on site to help us. From a PBL outcome and availability base, it's all about, you know, it's a lot of upside in it because the system is efficient. So if you got, again, you, and it's just where it's in a sustainment MRO type world where you know the ability of what's going on with your diagnostics, you know your mean time between failures, you know how many spares you need, you have a good spares plan, you know what to do if an error happens or issue comes down, or aircraft on the ground, or something like that. These are the type of contracts you'll see in those mindsets. So really high upside if you had an efficient process to execute it. It'll get in your teeth if you find a new problem under availability contract. It will cause all kind of trouble. How to execute when you don't know what the issue is and you don't have an answer. You can get caught up on an outcome based contract, that's for sure. But PBL as well, right?
Yeah, you'll never get to the outcome.
No, you never get to the outcome. Exactly. So let's jump into segment three. Segment three is about, you know, we just talked about the why, and then we told you the types. Then we're going to talk about here is just really give you a decision framework on which model to take that you're doing if you're in this in these sessions or BD sessions, really shaping the customer on what type of contract this effort should be on, right? And when you select it, you got to think about that contract model. When you select, you got to think about, you know, how you balance the uncertainty on what you can control, and then the incentives to make sure, because the incentives are where that, right? And here's some things you should be thinking about. Maybe about seven things, right? You, obviously, number one is technical maturity and risk, right? If you got a well understood system, right, it's probably gonna be fixed price. If it's brand new, you know, below TRL 6, you know, you probably want some risk that they lean on their side, right? And so you got to think about that. You got to think about another in your decision. You got to think about what's the customer risk appetite. Now, how much risk they willing to take? This is where you bring in your business development professionals who are usually have the close contact conversations with the end customer, saying how much risk are they willing to really take? How bad do they need this, you know, TRL-4 capability? How bad do they really need it? How much risk? And have we articulated that? This is where you got to go figure that out. Another thing is scope. You know, what's the scope clarity? How, you know, it's like building that sandbox and you setting that foundation on what the scope is, right? Because if you don't get the scope down, the scope creep will come. And if you don't have the cages to keep that scope creep in line, if you don't have that built in the contract, it's going to be some issues, just so you know. That's how it works. Mm-hmm. Other things like duration, how you want to expect change. Another thing about, you know, cash flow, capital overhead. That's all the when you think about how much you got to allocate towards it, to it. That's when your contract and your financial models really come in and kick in. When I talked about the administrative piece, what's the burden of all this audit and compliance, and how many seed rules, contract outline items I got to do, how many deed rules I got to do, how many data sources do we need, how much reporting alone can be expensive, right? I mean, you got to have a whole standing army to do reporting. And then last but not least, the incentives of, hey, if I get X, can we agree that I get Y? Right. And it's really that simple. And if they value the performance, which they all do, you want to incentivize, make sure the incentivization is in the contract. So when you hit those performance metrics, right? And that's important. You got an example on that, Rob, you want to walk us through?
Yeah, yeah. So I think, you know, one example comes to mind when, you know, let's suppose you're bidding a new satellite system. The architecture is risky, many unknowns in, you know, thermal, radiation, integration. But suppose you might propose a cost plus incentive fee in phases, in these phases. So early phases is cost based. Later phases is fixed price. Risks are retired, you know, if the customer is comfortable, you might build and award incentives for weight, launch margin, and also the schedule. So, you know, that's just a quick example about, you know, how you could walk through, you know, different cost models and how that could impact the various life cycles of your product, which is, you know, great, you know, from a contract model, because you have that structure that you spoke about earlier, how you understand it and how you walk through it with the customer. You know, I think at the end of the day, it all comes down to what you and the customer could agree to. And that's like the legalese to, you know, work that out from that standpoint. But, you know, the basis of understanding of, you know, that framework, the decision framework you talked about, and how that moves forward is going to be, you know, great for your knowledge going forward.
Excellent. Yeah. So let's get into a couple more other things, and then we're going to close out. Really going to talk about, you know, just the incentive piece and how to design that with the risk structure that you're going to put into. And then Rob also is going to, we're going to walk through some real world programs that just popped off now to show these various models that will give you some examples of that. And then we'll close out for the day. But, you know, there are, you know, all types of risks on a program. You got schedule costs, integration, supply chain, and you got to weigh them, each one of them carefully, right? Separately, but equal. And then you got to limit your exposure if you're a contractor, right? You make sure you control what you can control. And like what's that old Samuel L. Jackson line, those known unknowns, right? From Boondocks, right? You better have some structure in your contract to help you deal with those things that unknowingly happen, right? You have a vendor part that's late, right? Or there's some regulatory changes that happen in the middle of, you know, of you performing this, executing this contract. Those are things that's there. You got to look at that. From an incentive perspective, you know, you can do all kinds of things. We kind of talked about it earlier. You can talk about, you know, sharing the cost, do a 50-50 split on the cost and the share of the savings and overruns. Customer love you giving back money to them. They always love that, right? You can talk about, you know, what helps with award fees or award incentives. For example, if you, you know, displaced a incumbent from another technology and you bring your technology in, you want to maybe get an award fee because you have a better delivery rate. You're going to propose a better delivery rate, on-time performance, on-time delivery than that past person. That might be something you want to put in there. Things like performance incentives, you know, mission success rate, default, and then also your milestone payments, scheduling incentives, and any time how you do your liquidated damages. All that stuff is in that incentive structure. And then you want to set the targets such that there's a motivation to exceed the baseline of what you want. But don't be so aggressive that everybody's failed. So you got to have this zone of performance that you want to have. You want to have a below the line piece, a target, a threshold, and then a structure of what you can do, because customers only going to pay you so much, right? But it depends on the hook. So you just got to be honest with that. You know, you can't start, hey, you're going to give me a 50% bump if I'm, you know, 10% or up on my OTD that don't make sense, right? Things like that. And then also with all these things, how are you going to manage the changes, right? And you got to have a mechanism if there's a rebaseline that needs to happen, because those are real. They happen. We don't like to say it, but rebaselining is, can be a bad word, but they happen. There's a truth in that. It's something, and it might be something you just can't control. And you got to make sure that you don't penalize yourself because you got to do that rebaseline. What are some real world examples that's coming out right now, Rob, that you can share with the audience?
Yeah. So two contracts that recently got awarded jumped to mind. So one being a DoD contract that Lockheed Martin received, which was for $600 million firm fixed price modification to support the lifecycle work on JASSM and the LRASM variants as part of the IDIQ vehicle. So like we talked about earlier, IDIQ vehicles are being used much more these days for a lot of like the development work and things like that as the overarching umbrella. Another example is really around Northrop Grumman receiving a firm fixed price extension for AESA radar work under the F-16 under another IDIQ vehicle. So I know that's near and dear to your heart, Dwayne. So I know that's something like from there. But you know what we learn from these is really around even the larger primes often layer that fixed price work inside of that broader IDIQ vehicles, giving that flexibility under a blanket contract. So that modifications are really common these days. So essentially, you know, re-amendments to scope, cost, and period performance, things like that happen a lot more frequently. And then new cost burdens. So let's say, for example, like cybersecurity compliance are increasingly non-negotiable overhead that you must bake into your cost models these days for, you know, bidding on new work.
Absolutely. And Rob, what kind of future trends are evolving models that's happening as well?
Five future trends that I'm seeing that's worth, you know, discussing a little bit further. So outcome and availability contracts that will proliferate as systems become networked and instrumented. Digital twinning, like we've always heard from the customer, and predictive analytics will allow contractors to better forecast risk and performance, shifting more accountability to the actual contractor. So that's something the government loves. More modular architectures, so that you could carve out contract lines more cleanly and manage that interface risk, and increase oversight and compliance costs. So cybersecurity, export controls, supply chain scrutiny will shape how much you bid. So getting a better understanding of those costs up front is going to be paramount to future contract awards. And then lastly, hybrid public-private funding models. So the big push for the government these days is they want stuff commercial off the shelf. So you want a plug-and-play model. And that's often outside of the contract vehicles or somewhat similar to firm fixed price. That's creeping into a lot more defense procurements these days from the government and the customer. So that's something to, you know, be very, you know, highly aware about.
Absolutely. The COTS has showed up in, you know, the last four contract proposals I've been a part of this year alone. So it is a real thing. That, as well as the oversight with the compliance for, you know, cybersecurity and export control is doing, as well as, and from an export perspective, you know, what's your rare earth mineral plan, you know, all those things. That's something that's causing a lot of increased oversight we got to make sure of to protect the technology that's coming out, particularly on the defense side. As we wrap up today, you know, let's think about a couple of things that we came through, right? You know, we talked about contract models are more than just, you know, legal plumbing, right? They shape engineering, margins, incentives, and risks. And you must match that model to the technical maturity, customer preferences, and what's happening in the program as a whole. Incentives must be balanced. You know, we want to be stretchable, but we want to achieve them. And you have to have a mechanism for change. And in the real world, programs right now are often mixed models with IDIQs that we talked about, different contract models that are occurring, and then hybrid structures that's coming about away. And then lastly, as the future shifts towards more outcome-based contracts and tighter compliance, this it's turned into an art form almost. It's not just cut and dry on how you put a contract together and negotiate a contract. Any closing things from your perspective, Rob?
You know, we hope this episode gives all of our listeners, from program managers to engineers and business leaders, that greater visibility into how contracts really drive the behavior and outcomes of programs. Next episode, I know we're aiming to have a guest from a major defense prime or a DOD acquisition official to walk us through, you know, current real-time contracts and how they're managing it. We really thank everyone for tuning into Brothers Aerospace and Defense. If you found this episode useful, please subscribe, rate, and share that. And as always, reach out to us with any feedbacks and questions. I know that we're really taking that to heart as far as making sure that we have impactful episodes as we move forward.
And then just to foot stomp that some more, you know, this episode right here came from our friends at the NASA Black Engineers Aerospace Special Interest Group. And they really wanted someone to just break it down for those things. And if you have topics like this or any other around in this space, hey, we're your experts. We lived it. And we're willing to give you some advice to share around this. So until next time, let's stay forward leaning. Let's keep growing, keep sharing. And we really appreciate you joining this episode.